Direction point! Direction point!
A Doctor Who Podcast Network.
Well, hi everybody, and welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, the podcast taking you through the world of the Doctor Who novelizations put out by Target Books from 1973 onward in publication order. My name is Jason, and I'm your host on this journey, this very long journey. We're a member of the Direction Point Podcast Network. This is going to be a very short introduction. Things are very busy in Brooklyn this week. The book, Doctor Who, The Caves of Androzani, the Terence Dicks novelization of the final Peter Davison TV story. My guest, Paul Scoones. Let's get to it. But first, a quick word from Jim Sangster over at the news desk.
This is the news from the worlds of Doctor Who with me, Jim Sangster. The musical soundtracks from two more Doctor Who serials are about to be released on CD. Pages for Revenge of the Cybermen and Time and the Rani appeared on Amazon earlier this month, with a release date of the 24th of November, priced £11.99 in the UK. In book news, friends of the show Dale Smith and Simon Guerrier are featured in the latest Black Archive volumes from Obfirst Books. Published back in August, The Greatest Show in the Galaxy by Dale Smith takes us to the dying days of Doctor Who, while this month's release goes to the very beginning with The Edge of Destruction by Simon Guerrier. It's a busy time for Simon, as his new biography of David Whittaker, published by 10 Acre Films, should be hitting shelves on the 6th of November. There's a special launch event on the 9th of November at Manchester's Portico Library, and I'll be in attendance there too, so if you see me there, say hello. A Kickstarter for a new graphic novel by Cutaway Comics passed its first goal within 24 hours of launch when it was announced earlier this month. Inferno, The World Dies Screaming, is a prequel to the Third Doctor adventure Inferno, with a script by Gary Russell and art by John Ridgway. There are plenty of stretch goals as part of this Kickstarter campaign, including a novella inspired by The Mind of Evil, again written by Gary Russell, with Target-style illustrations by, me. So hopefully when Gary finishes writing the book, I'll be able to start illustrating it. For viewers in the UK, the BBC has just announced that a huge clump of Doctor Who material will be coming to iPlayer in November. Over 800 episodes from old and new Who, as well as Doctor Who Confidential, Torchwood, The Sarah Jane Adventures, and Class. The old Doctor Who website will also be revived with the arrival of archive documents detailing the genesis of Doctor Who and some newly scanned high-res photos from the BBC Picture Library. The makers of Doctor Who magazine will be releasing a special bookazine to mark the anniversary. Doctor Who 60 Moments in Time is a 224-page celebration of the series, priced £19.99 in the UK. And in this month's Doctor Who magazine, Russell T. Davis teased that the production team recently spent 6 days filming something special for the anniversary. Though, as he didn't specify what that actually was, we can speculate to our heart's content about what it might turn out to be. Doctor Who The After Party 2, anyone? For Doctor Who Literature, this is Jim Sangster, Manchester, UK.
You are invited on an adventure across all of time and space, in a completely random order. It's the Police Box in the Junkyard podcast. Jump in the TARDIS with your hosts,
Eric Gulbranson,
Asad Heshki,
and
Matthew Kressel.
Explore Doctor Who TV stories, audio adventures, and books, both novels and non-fiction. The Police Box in the Junkyard podcast. It's the entire Whoniverse. On Shuffle. The Police Box in the Junkyard podcast is a member of the Direction Point Network and is available about once a month wherever you find your podcasts. You are listening to the Doctor Who Literature podcast.
Very happy to welcome back to Doctor Who Literature, Mr. Paul Scoones. Paul, thank you for joining me for a second time.
Well, thank you for having me back.
We are here today to talk about what is one of my favorite stories of all time, and it's quite possibly one of yours as well, because you have done some pretty extensive work on this story for the DVD release. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
But before we talk about caves, since we are in the run-up to the 60th anniversary, and since we are recording this conversation a few hours after the final trailer dropped for the RTD 60th anniversary trilogy of stories, I wanted to ask you something I've been asking all of my guests lately. And I realize this is a very big question, but I am interested in hearing your off-the-cuff answer. What is your favorite TV Doctor Who story of the past 60 years?
Warrior's Gate.
Warrior's Gate. It's really interesting because everybody that I've asked so far, and these episodes for the month of October have all been recorded out of sequence, so I've spoken to some people whose episodes have not aired yet. Everybody has given me a classic series story, and several of you have given me a Tom Baker story, but I love Warrior's Gate, and I covered that book on the show a while back. What about Warrior's Gate makes it your all-time favorite, over and above everything else?
I think it's extremely well-written and extremely well-directed, and it's not a typical Doctor Who story. It stands out because it's just so unusual, and it requires deeper thought than just watching it. And it's also nostalgia, too, because as a young impressionable fan, it really made a big impact on me. I was really, really impressed with it the first time I watched it, and it stuck with me ever since. I mean, I could pick any number of stories from classic or new Doctor Who to answer your question, but Warrior's Gate is the one I keep coming back to. It's consistently been a favourite of mine ever since I've been a fan of the series. So it's my all-time fave. And I guess, too, as a slight sort of perversity about it, too, that it's not a typical classic in inverted commas. It's not one of the sort of the typical top 10. And I like the idea of having a favorite that isn't everyone else's favorite.
I will tell you that I've already done my top 60 list. I've already ranked, and people tell me that I'm crazy for doing this, but I've ranked my top 60 all-time stories for the past 60 years. And I revealed part of my list at the L.I. Who convention back in August. I released that on a bonus episode of Doctor Who Lit. But I'm also going to be doing a full episode in time for the 60th anniversary on this show where I count down my top 60 and explain why. Not exactly a spoiler, but Warrior's Gate is going to be somewhere on that list.
And that was going to be my question to you.
Not in the top 5, not in the top 10, but it does have a very respectable place in the top 60, and not just number 60 or 59 either. It's up there. But it's one of those stories that I didn't get at first. This is one of those Tom Baker stories that aired after my PBS station had moved the show to 11:30 p.m., and of course I'm 11, 12 years old. There was just no question of staying up that late, except for Friday night. So I was able to see part one of Warriors, which happened to air on a Friday night. I want to say December 1985. Never saw parts two and three and four for quite a while after that. And the book was a little bit of a challenge to get through because it didn't have chapters. And at that age, I was very trained to read chapter books. And having a book where I didn't know where to stop and which didn't have neat little prefabricated divisions was a little bit puzzling for me. That probably says more about young Jason than it does about Stephen Gallagher.
I think I would have been the same age as you when I first saw it, but I first saw it in 1981, and I'm just thinking I probably would have been about 12, 13, maybe.
Did you love the story right away, or did it take you a few viewings to finally clue into what it was all about and what it meant?
I didn't have the luxury of a few viewings because No such thing as a VCR back then, so it was one viewing only, and then it was wait for the target novelization and read that over and over again. That was literally the extent of my exposure to Doctor Who, was a one-off viewing, and then read the target books over and over again. So, I was sufficiently entranced by it, shall we say. I wouldn't claim to have understood everything, but certainly after reading the book a few times, everything I remembered of the television story made sense.
I do remember that shortly after I would have seen the part one, where Birok walks through the mirror and the manacles drop off. I know I was having dreams about that particular scene at a very young age, but what's interesting is that thanks to the VHS release and the DVD and eventually the Blu-ray release, I've seen this story when I was 20 years younger than Gallagher when he wrote it. Mm. And now I've seen this story now that I'm 20 years older than Gallagher when he wrote it. And it's amazing the things that he was writing in his late 20s. Yeah. I was 20 years older than I would not be able to write a script of the complexity and with the breadth of technical and cultural and observational humor references. Now, I realize that some of the script is due and owing to Christopher H. Bidmead and Paul Joyce, as well as to Gallagher. But, I mean, I would never have been able to talk about the I Ching or about plotting your coordinates by the toss of a coin. These are all things that were in Gallagher's original draft. Have you had a chance to read the second Gallagher novelization, which just came out from the Targets and was also an audiobook a few years back?
No, I'm still waiting to receive a copy of that. I have a copy on order, but it hasn't arrived as yet.
I know the paperback supplies have been impossible to get in the States, so I ended up buying and I know Amazon doesn't need any more purchases from me, but I bought the Kindle copy because I was covering it over on Trap One, so I had to read the book by a date certain. Mm. So I have heard the audio, and I have read the ebook, which is not quite the same as having the paper novelization. But it's very interesting to kind of reverse engineer this rough Gallagher draft from 1980 and see what isn't there from the eventual Gallagher / Joyce / Bidmead.
Hmm.
Final draft.
I've always been fascinated by this extended version of the original version, shall we say, of the novelization. And I think probably I learned about it from reading an interview with Stephen Gallagher in Doctor Who magazine, maybe, where he would have made reference to the fact that he'd had to cut a whole lot out. And I would have gone, at the time, I would have been absolutely entranced by this notion that there was the possibility of an extended cut. And I've been fortunate. I'm a very big fan of Stephen Gallagher's work outside of Doctor Who. I've got a big collection of his horror novels. And I've actually been fortunate enough to correspond with him online too. And you know, even years before this even came up, I was suggesting to him the notion of doing doing an extended cut of Warrior's Gate. So I'm delighted that he finally got the opportunity to do so.
I got to see him speak at Galley in Los Angeles in February 2022. I signed up for one of those small group sessions with the guests. So it was eight of us sitting around a boardroom table with Stephen Gallagher, holding court about the origin of this story and what happened to Terminus once it fell into Eric Sayward's hands.
I am very envious.
Yeah, very fascinating. Off the cuff, you know, very, very good stories, excellent recall, very good in a small group. And then he was on the Who Corner to Corner podcast recently, telling many of the same stories, and it's definitely worth a listen. As hesitant as I am to recommend that somebody listen to a podcast that is not my own, those two guys did a very good job interviewing him.
No, I've listened to that one. He actually mentions me on it.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
I sent in a question, and Stephen Gallagher was kind enough to say that he remembered me from corresponding with me. So that was nice.
That's right. But we're really here to talk today about...
Sorry, we're derailing ourselves, aren't we?
Well, it was my own fault for asking you a question and really, really enjoying your answer and wanted to dig pretty deep into it. So I'm holding up my copy of the Caves of Androzani novelization. I loved this book as a kid, and I read it over and over again, but I'd seen the TV story first. It was my first regeneration. So when I was, 11 or 12, I loved the story because it was a regeneration story. It's, again, one of those stories that the more I watch it and the more I read the book, the more I get out of it. So I'm curious, as having heard your journey with Warrior's Gate, what's your journey with this particular Caves of Androzani?
Well, I'm the other way around from you, because I read the book first, and we are talking long before I saw it on television. Because, and I probably need to provide a little bit of context here, because I'm in New Zealand. And in 1983, for whatever reason, Television New Zealand, who were showing Doctor Who, decided they'd take a long break from showing Peter Davison stories. And they'd go back and show Trout and Pertwee, Tom Baker. And this took 5 years before they caught back up. So there was a long time of not getting new Doctor Who. And season 21 was the first complete season that we just didn't get for 5 years. So I was with no other way of, I didn't have any overseas pen pals who could send me tapes. I didn't have any other means. I didn't have any friends who had copies. So I didn't have any means of seeing these stories. However, I was reading Doctor Who magazine and I was collecting the Target novels. So after the news story stopped screening, I basically reverted to just encountering each new story from Terminus onwards as a book rather than as a television story. So by the time of Kayser and Azani, the Target novelization was it for me. My visualization of what the story must have been like, my impression of what the story was, is a completely based on Terence Dix's novelization rather than the television story.
So you, obviously in New Zealand, you're three quarters of a world away from me here in Brooklyn. And I should point out that with daylight savings time just about being over, but with daylight saving time ending differently in different countries, I think it ended for you today, and it hasn't quite ended here in New York yet. We are 16 hours apart, so I am speaking to you late, late on a Saturday night, and you were speaking to me presumably close to sunset on Sunday, which begs an interesting observation. I'm going to have to contrive a way, Paul, to record with you on New Year's Eve / New Year's Day, so that we are not only talking on different days, but we're talking in different years.
Yes.
So I'm going to have to be able to pull a Morton Dill and ask, y'all have different years here?
I'm talking to you from the future.
I mean, that could work with somebody in the UK if I record at 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. That's not very practical, but you and I have practically different days.
Yeah,
we can both be wide awake, and it's the middle of the day for you and evening for me. So much more practical. So coming back to New Zealand fandom and you being much, much younger, did you know what was going to happen in the Androzani book? Did you know the outlines of the TV story? Did you know this was a book where the Doctor dies at the end when you first picked it up?
I was thinking about this just today, anticipation of this, and I think I probably did because, as I mentioned, I was getting Doctor Who magazine, so they would have had the coverage of the story, and I'm pretty sure they did one of those archive summary features shortly after Kayser and Azani aired, to sort of mark this sort of, you know, landmark occasion. I think they ran that pretty quickly after the story aired, certainly the same year. So I think I would have known the story outline by the time I got the novelization, which would have arrived in, well, publication date, 1985, the paperback came out. So it would have been sometime the following year. So yes, in answer to your question, I would have known the storyline. I would have known what happened in it, thanks to reading Doctor Who magazine.
I can tell you, you might appreciate this, Caves of Androzani, in my very young fandom, was the very first Doctor Who story that I had spoiled for me in advance. And considering that I didn't have access to DWM or the internet in 1984, and I only had two other friends who watched Doctor Who, those kind of spoilers were very hard to come by. But we had an hour cable television system on Long Island in the mid-80s, we had access to five or six different PBS stations, all showing Doctor Who at different times and at different cycles. And when your cable box only has 30 channels, and six of them are PBS from all over the Northeast, my friend happened to be watching Doctor Who on a Boston station, and they were about 3 weeks ahead of us on the very first U.S. Peter Davison broadcast cycle. bearing in mind that Caves is March 1984, and this story is airing in the States towards the end of 84. So my friend was watching ahead on this Boston station, and he had seen Caves 3 weeks earlier, and he told me that all he could tell me was that the Doctor dies in the story, and there's a character in a black and white mask. And I had actually been flipping channels, and I had actually seen, unbeknownst to me at the time, I had seen this random scene out of context where the Doctor and who I thought was Tegan were walking across the desert in Longshot having a conversation. I didn't clue on the fact that Perry was actually trying to do an American accent and not an Australian one. It was all the same to me.
So what you're saying is if you'd stuck with that, you would have seen it from the beginning.
That's right. But instead, my friend Stephen, and Stephen is going to be at galley with me in early 2023, so maybe I can get him to tell the story in a group. But so finally, when Channel 21 cycles around, and I remember this vividly because it was the last week of 1985, sorry, the last week of January 1985, so right around the time the book comes out, in fact, I didn't know that yet. When at the end of part one, I see the reflection of Jack's black and white mask in his TV monitor, I immediately had this surge of adrenaline knowing, oh my goodness, this is a story where, and I'd seen The Five Doctors, so I knew about regeneration. Right. I'm like, oh, this is the story where he dies. Oh. So by the time the Doctor, and it's such a visual feast of a regeneration, I guess we'll come to that later, I was just so energized, and the regeneration happens on a Friday night for us. I literally floated up the stairs in joy and then fell back down again because I wasn't watching where I was going.
Sure.
Fortunately, I was okay, but that's how much I was excited for Andrew Zani. And then the book comes out a little bit later. So you read the book first. You would have known what was happening from WM.
Coming back to your original question, because like you, I've got the book in front of me. If I hadn't been a Doctor Who magazine reader and I had first encountered this story by picking the Target book up off the shelves and buying it in the bookshop, I noticed that the back cover blurb gives away the fact of the regeneration.
That's true. You're right. I'd forgotten about that.
So it would have been, assuming that I would have read that before I started reading the book, as I probably would have always done, it's kind of like, it's a bit odd, isn't it? It's a bit spoilerific.
This is probably the point in time where the Target editors realize that they're speaking to a very dialed-in audience and that the occasional back cover blurb spoiler isn't going to harm anybody, perhaps.
Perhaps. I think they probably thought that the regeneration was probably a key selling point of the novel and wanted to include that fact. So if you were a Target reader who was only buying selected books, but wanted to get the ones where the important events happen, shall we say, then that would be a selling point for you.
And I realize that I'm asking this question out of order, but I have been curious about this for a long time and I've seen different answers. But let's take a look at the cover. So you've got that amazing Andrew Skilleter, I think, painting of Shara's Jack. And above him you have a man's face in a sort of tunnel graphic, mostly yellow with some red. Who is that face that is above Shara's Jack's? Because when I was a kid, I assumed it was what Jack was like before the accident. But other folks have said that it's the Doctor in mid-regeneration. Are you aware, or do you have a guess?
The latter.
Ah.
It's the Doctor in mid-regeneration. It's probably the closest that Andrew Skilleter can do to doing Colin Baker's face, given that he's not actually permitted to use Colin Baker's face.
Without the mop of a blonde hair, I guess it's hard to tell.
Yeah, it's he's trying to represent the regeneration there. The thing that I always find amusing when I look at this cover is like I said, because my impression of this story was based on the reading the book and seeing the book before I saw the television stories, I was convinced that Sarah's Jack had a black tongue. And then obviously later on I realized, oh, that's actually his teeth on the inside of his mouth. it looks like he's poking out a black tongue.
I had never picked up on that. I guess I was distracted by the Doctor in mid-regeneration. But yeah, now that you've told me that, I really can't unsee it.
Yeah.
So when did you finally see Caves as a television story?
Oh, okay. 1987. I was at university and I made contact with a fellow Doctor Who fan and we decided to start a fan club, got in touch with other people, and by that means I got in contact with people who had off-air recordings that they'd got from overseas. And there was quite a big swapping network going on, because as I mentioned that we were on New Zealand television, we were screening Pertwee and Tom Baker stories, and they were much in demand by UK fans because obviously these hadn't been repeated there. And so they were just, and the VHSs hadn't come out yet, so they were absolutely desperate to get hold of these stories. So there was quite a equitable swapping relationship of, we'll send, you know, off airs of stories you haven't seen yet in return for these repeats that we desperately want to see. So I would have got to see Kaiser and Azadi for the first time on VHS as an off air recording borrowed off a friend.
And when you say you made contact, I guess as a Doctor Who fan, you really should say contact had been made.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I always thought when I went to university in 1987, there'd be established club of, you know, if not Doctor Who fans, then a science fiction club that had a lot of Doctor Who fans in it. And I was quite dismayed that although there was a science fiction club at university, they were very dismissive of television science fiction. They were very much a group of literary fans, which was fine. I mean, I read a lot of science fiction novels at the time, but they were very dismissive of the idea of anyone being a fan of television science fiction, let alone just Doctor Who. So I put a notice up on the club notice board at university campus, saying, you know, anyone else interested in Doctor Who would love to meet up. And one person replied, and this was a fellow first year student called Paul Sinkovich, and Paul was the one who had all these pen pal contacts. He was a member of the Doctor Who Appreciation Society in the UK, and between us we set up the fanzine Time Space Visualizer, which became the fanzine of the New Zealand Doctor Who Fan Club, and I ran for 25 years. It was the beginning of all that.
I have mentioned TSV many times on this show, and I'm hoping to have you back to talk about the novelizations at some point. And
absolutely.
You've sent me links to some of your TSV articles about related topics as well, so mm-hmm. Just an endlessly fascinating read.
A long time in my past now, but yeah, it was certainly very active for a long time. And I credit TSV with getting the professional work I do now, because I don't think I would have got that if I hadn't done the fanzine.
Well, I'm very happy that you started that, and I'm very happy that you're so involved as you are today, and of course, talking to me. So, seeing Cave's off-air copy, you've read the book, you have a good sense from Terrence's text as to what the Robert Holmes script is like. What was it like, and now you're a little bit older, you're in college, you're seeing these visuals, or university, I should say, you're seeing these visuals for the first time. What was the very first impression the story made on you?
This is an interesting point, because I was borrowing a lot of these VHS tapes of, they would have been all the Colin Baker stories and all the Davison ones I hadn't seen. So everything from Terminus onwards up to the Trial of a Time Lord. So basically all of those bulk of tapes I would have seen in a very short space of time. So I was just basically, you know, mainlining them as fast as I could to get through them all these missing stories that I hadn't seen. Bear in mind, I'd read most of the novels. I'd read, obviously, all the novels that had been published at that point. So I'd formed very detailed mental impressions from reading those books of what the television stories must be like. So I thought that that Warriors of the Deep would be an excellent story. I thought that Terminus would be an excellent story. You see where I'm going with this? Because the books are so good. And so, I mean, some of these stories were terrible disappointments when I got to see them, because I just got this mental impression of what the stories were like. And Kaiser Andrazani stands out in that it's one of the few television stories that exceeded my expectation based on the book. In other words, I thought more highly of the television story than I did of the novelization, whereas usually it was the reverse.
It's really gratifying to hear you say that, because we've talked about Warriors of the Deep on this show already in a recent episode. We've talked about Terminus on this show already in a recent episode. Warriors was actually the first of the season 21 novelizations to come out, and it's the same author as this novelization, Terrence Dix. With Terminus, again, we're talking about Stephen Gallagher for the second time in 30 minutes.
It's a superb novelization.
The themes are in much more, the contrast, the garb is much more effective. Plus, he goes into so much more hard sci-fi detail. Plus, it's the longest Target novelization in about 8 years.
Yeah.
It is just a really complex, original sci-fi novel in its own right, and it benefits from not having the script editor that it did, and it benefits from not having the director that the TV did, and it benefits from not having Roger Limb's music numbing your ears for 4 consecutive weeks, 25 at a time.
Also, too, for me, it was the book, speaking particularly about Terminus, it's the book that I spent the longest time not having seen the television story, because it's the first one that didn't screen in New Zealand. So they stopped with Mordred Undead. So when Terminus came out, it was like getting the first of the New Adventures novels, if you follow what I'm saying. It was the first,
oh yes,
it was the first book off the end of the line.
It was your first chance to read an original Doctor Who fiction after the end of the TV series. So
it literally did feel like original fiction, because I had absolutely no way of seeing the television. From as far as I was concerned, the television story just didn't even really, I knew it existed, and it was just a case of having to wait. And to be honest, I didn't know how long I was going to have to wait. You know, if you'd told me in the end of 1983, well, that's the end of Mordred Undead, you've now got to wait 5 years, I would have just been horrified. But I just thought, oh, they're taking a break for Christmas and they'll be back in the new year. You know what I'm saying? It was just, I had no way of knowing I'd have such a long wait ahead of me.
It's a credit that your fandom survived that 5-year interregnum, of course.
Well, this is pertinent to the podcast, but I credit Target Books for keeping my interest alive.
Mm. So you see the TV story of Caves, and it improves your estimation of the book, obviously, because it's so, not to put words in your mouth, visually inventive, and the performances are so keen. And Graham Harper was not new to the show. He had, of course, been the PA on Warrior's Gate, which was already your favorite story.
And the unofficial assistant director of the story, too.
That's right, especially for those 2 hours where Paul Joyce was fired and hiding out in the BBC.
Well, by all accounts, Paul Joyce actually delegated a lot of the work that he should have been doing to Graham Harper, certainly in terms of planning the shots.
I should have looked this up before I spoke to you tonight, but of course I didn't know Warrior's Gate was going to be your favorite story. Did you work on the production notes for that one as well?
No, the timing was off. When I was first asked to do the production notes, and we were having very, very early conversations about what stories I'd want to do, because I was just getting involved at that point, and I mentioned Warrior's Gate, which at that point hadn't been announced, and the reaction was, oh, sorry, that's only just been assigned. So I just missed out on that one.
Oh, no. So you have been on the show before, and we have talked about the production notes before, but I want to revisit some of that conversation because it's been nearly a year since we spoke last. That was for Armageddon Factor, which I believe I recorded at the very end of 2022. And here we are in the last quarter of 2023. When I read the production notes, and I have to say, the production notes is always the first way that I experience the story. Then I do the audio commentary second, and then I do the documentaries and the featurettes third. Since I watched my first production note on Spearhead from Space, when the first DVDs came out in America, and the first DVDs came out in America on September 11th, 2001. So obviously we were not in the great headspace that week. But I put on the Spearhead DVD just as a way of escaping the outside world. Sure. And when I didn't know 90% of the information in the production notes. And I'm like, wow, this is the best way to experience Doctor Who ever. I have been a production note fanboy for the last 22 years. But you know this already. When I read them, I have like these mental palpitations. Like I would never be able to not only amass that level of detail, but to write what's essentially a 100-minute script where I have to correlate specific captions to specific moments in the text. And one of the amazing things that you guys do is you time puns and fandom jokes with specific lines of dialogue. I'm like, the level of mental effort that must be involved and the amount of man hours that must be involved in putting this together, it makes me queasy. Like, how do you do this? How do you physically organize and mentally organize all this information and make them so good?
I question my sanity every time I do one. I'm only being slightly facetious there, because it really is very intense. There's a lot of work involved.
And I will not ask how many you've done, because I'm sure you've done some that have not come out on Blu-ray yet.
I've done about 13 or 14 so far.
Wow.
I mean, telling you how many I've done doesn't give any spoilers away, surely.
I have not correlated a list of all the ones that I've read of yours, but I'm sure it's been at least half a dozen.
Well, if I can summarize it, I mean, of the ones that have been released, I've done Earthshock, Five Doctors, which has just come out on Blu-ray.
That's on its way across the pond. I ordered the UK release, but I don't have it in New York yet.
No, it's fine. I don't have a copy yet either. All of season 21, except the first and last story. So I didn't do Warriors of Deep and I didn't do Twin Dilemma. I did every other season 21 story. I'm going through them chronologically. I did Vengeance on Varos, Mark of the Rani. I co-wrote all of Trial of a Time Lord with another writer, because it was way too big job for one writer.
Of course, it's 14 episodes.
And then Dragonfire, Battlefield, and Scream of the Shalka.
That's right. I have read the Scream of the Shalka, a story that I've only seen once, but yes, I have read that technically.
So yeah, that's my published. I have done more, so I had to be careful as I went through that list. But,
of course.
But that's my published work to date in terms of, and that's a mixture of DVD and Blu-ray. And it should be said too that I only started working on these in 2008. And so when I talk about how I've done almost all of season 21, a lot of those are what they call the revisitations DVDs. They're not the original releases. So because the up to 2008, most of the info text was fairly basic and didn't necessarily refer to the original production paperwork. It was based more on interviews and what was commonly known about the story. In 2008, there was a rethink about how they wanted to do the production notes, and that's when they brought a larger team of writers on board, of which I was one. And the idea being from that point onwards that they would be done to a much higher, more exacting academic level. So whenever those revisitation stories, whenever they re-release the DVDs, they would scrap the original set of info text and start from scratch. So when I did Kayser and Dazani, it was the revisitations box set re-release, not the original DVD that came out in about 2001.
Which I also own, but I upgraded to the special edition. So I have definitely read yours. And I know very specifically when I watched yours the last time as part of my Twitter pilgrimage. When I did my Twitter pilgrimage and watched the entirety of the classic series in 13 months, I had the DVD commentary on for every single one of those, two episodes per night. So when I had read the Androzani novelization, there had been one particular line of prose where the sound of a mudburst, Terence writes, is like a million whistling tea kettles. And I thought that was a very odd image, and it wasn't the writing style from Terence that I was used to. You have access to the production paperwork, and you point out in the info text that is literally Robert Holmes' stage direction for the scene, which was an interesting window for me as to how the novelization was written. Terence must have dropped in bits of Robert Holmes's prose into his prose just as a way of keeping the flavor of the way that Robert Holmes thinks and writes. And I had not been thinking of that when I read the books before, but now I had this little window onto the camera script, which I would not have seen before.
It's a curious mix because, I skim read the novelization in preparation for this podcast, so I was reminded of it. Terence is, as you say, he's using the script naturally as a reference source, but I think it's also fairly obvious that he's had access to a video copy of the story too, because he makes all sorts of observations about the costumes and the look of things. So there's detail in there that he can't have got from the script. He has to have seen a video of it as well, and also too, Robert Holmes' script went through extensive rewriting during production. The actual broadcast copy of the script is a mishmash of cut up, reordered, handwritten notes, because partly the story was hit by strike action.
Oh.
And partly Graham Harper, for whatever reason, seriously ran out of time in studio, so had to on the fly make massive changes, massive cuts to actually just get the story in on time. So Terence incorporates all of those changes. Basically what we have, I think, is Terence has written, he's got the script in front of him, but he's also, I think, got a VHS copy in front of him, and so he's basically being very careful to make sure that if what is in Robert Holmes' script doesn't appear in the television story, he doesn't include it.
Interesting. So if Robert Holmes' script had been given to, let's say, a less visually inclined director like a Ron Jones, and Ron Jones had just produced what Robert Holmes has on the page, do you think the story would have been received differently, or do you think the magic of Holmes' ideas still might have shown through?
I think Kaiser Androzani, or shall we give it its proper title of the Blowholes of Androzani Minor, it absolutely succeeds in spite of itself. Because I don't think, because everything's working against it. Like I mentioned to you, it was hit by strike action. They were in danger of losing their cast because they had to reschedule the studio dates. And Morris Roeves, who plays Stotts in particular, had gone back to America. So they had to pay him to come back to the UK. Mm. And they were considering having to recast him. So all sorts of terrible things. In some ways, it's quite reminiscent to what happened with Enlightenment, in terms of like that strike action causing them to have to just rethink everything and delay the studio. So that's really working against it. And then, as I say, they had to just keep rejiggering the script as they were filming, because time was against them, the complexity of the shots. When I talk about that, if you didn't know which story I was talking about, you're going, this sounds like a disaster, as in terms of a production. This is just going to not look good on screen. So the fact that Kaiser Androzani is so highly regarded as one of the best Doctor Who stories of all time is a minor miracle, I think, given what I know about the behind-the-scenes production of it.
How close were we to having Michael Kreese play Krelper?
Graham Harper wanted him. He was his first choice for the role, and it was vetoed by John Nathan Turner, because Nathan Turner had got a bee in his bonnet, because fans had criticized him for using Jacqueline Hill in Megalos in a different role. And I think probably the criticism from fans was that she was underused and they would have preferred to have seen her given a bigger part, given her stature in Doctor Who. But I think Nathan Turner just basically saw that as, if I don't use old actors in new roles, then I'm not going to get criticized for that. So I suspect that's where he was coming from.
And not to take anything away from Roy Holder, I think Roy Holder is amazing. And this is it's potentially a quaternary part. It's a character who hardly interacts with the Doctor at all. Hmm. Krelper is so lively on screen, the way that Roy Holder plays him. I've always enjoyed the character. And that scene where Stotts is trying to get him to bite into the cyanide capsule is incredible. I can see Michael Kreese based on my memory of him as Ben playing that same part. I think that he would have crushed it, and I'm just sorry that we didn't get to see that, even though the end result was still excellent.
I have to kind of just side with John Nathan Turner here. I think as a fan, I might have found that distracting. Because I'm not familiar with Roy Holder, I'm not looking at his performance and going, "Oh, it's Ben." You know what I'm saying? I'm not. In the same way, I find Megloss a bit distracting in that respect. That you can't really look at. I think is it Lexa, the character that Jacqueline Hill plays, without, because your fan brain clicks in and goes, "There's Barbara." So yeah, I kind of side with the producer on this one. I think it is distracting.
I just want to say, in defense of the respective casting choices, it is amazing to see Jacqueline Hill play an antagonist. And yes, there's more that could have been done with the part, and that's obviously on the way the story came out of production with the director, etc. I think she's excellent, and she really is enjoying playing the antagonist. It would be nice, and we get a lot of this now from Big Finish, where the actors come back and play different characters. It would have been nice to have on screen Michael Kreese playing a very different role to Ben.
And I guess the argument could be made that in 1984, how many people would have seen, how many people would have remembered Michael Kreese as Ben? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Unless you were of a certain age, you really didn't have any way of seeing his old stories.
But I guess with Ian Levine in the production office almost every day with his memories of what happened in the past, I guess he always would have stood in the way.
Possibly. I don't know. I don't know that side of it. But certainly I think that there's an argument to be made in both directions. But I don't know. I think that maybe they made the right decision there, I just think that's my fan brain that I wouldn't have been able to disassociate the actor from the role.
What are some other things that surprised you as you're digging deep into the production file for the second crack at the Androzani production notes?
As I touched on before, just how much the script changed. Because Robert Holmes had delivered a very solid set of scripts. They read really, really well, but just the nature of the production meant that they were just chopping and changing. And I did as much as possible put those deleted scenes into the info text. There's a lot of quoted lines from the script in there because it's just such great material. The writing is so strong. And it's unfortunate too, because some of the sense of the story is lost in that writing being cut. For instance, when the Doctor and Perry first arrive on the planet and they're going on and on about glass. Now, the reason they're doing that is because there's a whole scene in the TARDIS where the Doctor is enthusing about visiting a monastery to do some glass blowing.
Huh.
And so it's a continuation of an existing conversation, but without the first half of it, it doesn't make nearly as much sense. And as a viewer, you're kind of going, why are they wittering on and on about glass? And there's other scenes. I mean, for instance, one of the early scenes has one of the troopers setting up a theodolite to survey the caves, and then they're attacked by the magma beast and he's killed. Now, that scene was supposed to set up a sequence at the end of the story where the Doctor's descending into the caves to get the bat milk. And he's supposed to come across the magma beast. And he defends himself by picking up that theodolite and actually using it as a spear to drive the magma beast over the edge of a cliff.
Oh, wow.
So that's actually in the script.
That was a question that I had, because earlier today, we're recording this Sunday evening for you, late Saturday night for me. Earlier today, one of our Twitter mutuals, the guy who calls himself Mester and the Magnificent, was watching and live tweeting about Androzani. And the only criticism he had about the entire story was the magma beast. And some of the responses said, the Magma Beast wasn't part of the original story, but J&T insisted on having a monster in there. But what you're saying is that the Magma Beast was always part of Holmes's script and actually has a much bigger role in the climax.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I disagree with anyone who tells you otherwise. The Magma Beast had a bigger role in the script. And to be fair, Robert Holmes wasn't in charge of designing that beast. So from his point of view, he's writing in a monster with the expectation that it's going to be, you know, it's going to be okay on screen. He has no expectation that it's going to be so poorly realized. So he has no reason to cut back its appearance.
The reason I like the Magma Beast, and I realize I may be the first human being in history to actually say that combination of words in that order. The reason I like the Magma Beast is because Androzani is this fascinating story where Perry is the damsel in distress, and the Doctor is this moral beacon who will do whatever it takes to fight his way through a war zone to save her life, even though in story terms he's only known her for about 2 weeks of 1984 calendar time. Every character, every human character in the story is massively flawed in some way. Even General Chelak, who you can kind of sort of think is a brigadier surrogate with the mustache. Even the human version of Salatine. And how amazing is Robert Glenister in a double role?
Fantastic.
Oh. But even those two who are nominally the heroes, and if this were a unit story, they would have been the Brigadier and Benton. They are flawed characters who misuse Perry and are complicit in the Doctor's staged execution and don't have a happy ending. Well, nobody in the story has a happy ending except Perry. The Magma Beast is the only character in the story that the Doctor feels any sympathy for, because when the Magma Beast dies towards the end and the Doctor comes across its body, the Doctor says, "Not your lucky day either." It's literally the only being in the story that's being honest to its instincts and it's doing what it has to do. It's the only character in the story who is not a double crosser or...
Well, you see, but you're only getting that sympathy level for that character because of the rewrite.
And it's not what Robert Holmes intended for me to think.
Because that scene where the Doctor comes across the Magma Beast already dead is the substitution for that battle scene that I told you about.
Because they didn't have time to mount that battle scene in studio,
absolutely.
Probably.
And wow. Probably by that point, to be fair, Graham Harper had twigged to the fact that this monster costume really wasn't working, and so he probably wanted to minimize its appearance in the story. You know, quite aside from the fact they probably just realistically did not have the time to mount this battle scene.
All credit to Graham Harper for that decision.
But to be fair, I mean, you know, every story has its Hammy the Hamster.
Every story has its Murka. Yeah. I imagine when you're reading The Warriors of the Deep novelization, you're not imagining the Murka as a paint smear.
You are not. The Murka is the most fearsome creature ever created when you read the novelization. and so is the rat in Talons of Wen Chiang. You know? on paper, the rat is fearsome. So, yeah, I mean, it's a long-standing tradition with Doctor Who that there's always something. Genesis of the Daleks has the clam.
That's right. Clammy the Clam, as somebody once said.
Clammy the Clam, yeah. So there we go. Any story you like to name probably has something that just lets it down, but the sheer weight of quality, you know, overrides that.
Let me ask you another question about Holmes' script, the regeneration. When Holmes was commissioned to write this, was it always commissioned as the regeneration story, or was that sort of a late addition that came in after the fact?
I believe that it was always going to be the regeneration story, yes. I think that was part of the brief. But I think, and I'd, you know, I'm going from memory here, it's a long time since I researched this story, I believe that the Kayser Androzani was probably originally commissioned, or Chain Reaction, as it was originally called.
Right, right.
For the last story of season 21.
And of course, they ended up giving Colin Baker his own story at the end of season 21.
Yeah, the Peter Davison was contracted all the way to the end of season 21. So he was actually going to be in the final story. He was actually contracted and paid for all seven stories of that season. So,
but you know, JNT reads Caves of Androzani and says, wait, I've got a better idea for a season finale. Let's do the Twin Dilemma instead. Whoops.
The reason is not so much artistic, it's practical. Because remember what happened with the previous season?
Where the last story never got made.
They lost the final story. Now, that would have been catastrophic if they'd lost the final Peter Davison story off the end of that season. So John Nathan Turner quite cannily thought, if the same thing happens to us as happened the previous year and we lose the final story, at least Davison's era is wrapped up. That is the reason why we have Twin Dilemma on the end of that year, because of what had happened the previous year.
Well, I'm very sorry that the strike didn't materialize and scuttle the last story of season 21.
Well, technically it did, because they were both Androzani and Twin Dilemma were made under strike action, and their studios were delayed, but not so much that they actually lost the story.
The regeneration scene that we get. Now, I've heard, I think I might have gotten this from either Graham Harper's audio commentary or from the making of a feature on the Revisitations DVD. The regeneration scene owes a little bit to I, Claudius. However, I'm curious how much of the regeneration scene was Holmes, how much of it was Sayward, how much of it was Harper as scripted?
Hard to say, because we probably don't have an early enough a version of the script to know for certain that it was simply just Holmes's version without any input. But from memory, I think it is slightly different in the original script. But you know, there's bits that are different. But I don't think it's terribly different. But then, obviously, like I say, I'm not entirely sure that was entirely just Holmes's own work. He may have left that to Sayward to include. I'm not sure. Yeah, without going back and having a detailed look at my notes from many years ago, I'd have to. I'm not sure.
The notion that the Fifth Doctor's last word is Adric, the companion who died, is pretty fascinating, but I can't imagine that would have been a Robert Holmes decision purely, as he would not have been around for Earthshock. That sounds a little more like it's going to be Eric Sayward calling back to his own story.
I've got my production notes script open in front of me here, and after the Doctor says Adric, in the earliest version of the script we have, Perry says Doctor, and the Doctor is on the verge of panic. My past is catching up with me. I must regenerate. And then the Perry says, Doctor! And then the Doctor suffers his vision of the Master, and he falls back unconscious and then regenerates. So that's after the Adric line.
So Adric was not intended to be his last word, but it became his last word because of cuts.
And remember too, and this comes back to what I was saying before, the regeneration scene was recorded just before they turned the lights out. They were really, really short of time. They did not have time for retakes. They were just literally just quickly grab, you know, Colin Baker, have his idea, just shoved into the studio, right, do your bit because the lights are going to go out in 5 minutes sort of thing. So it really was quite a hasty thing, and it may be that they just made a snap decision to drop that line because they were so short of time.
It's 9:57 p.m. If he says that line, we're not going to have time to get Colin Baker rolling around on the floor.
Yeah, there's something too that I think is quite fascinating about this story, is that it's a hodgepodge of shall we say Robert Holmes's greatest hits, and it even it's, as you're probably aware, Robert Holmes was originally commissioned to write what became the Five Doctors, and his original brief, his original idea, had a android version of the Doctor and his companion, and that was going to
be
Hartnell Doctor and Susan were going to be androids in his original outline, based on the idea that, you know, you'd have to get another actor to play Hartnell, and Susan didn't look much like Susan anymore. So he thought if you had android duplicates, it would explain away why they look different. So that was Robert Holmes's pitch for what became Five Doctors. So you can see that that's the germ of the idea for Androzani right there.
Gets recycled a little bit. Interesting.
It does.
And I've talked about this elsewhere. There's a lot of similarities between Shara's Jack and Magnus Greel. They both use the word jackanapes to describe the Doctor. Even the makeup is a little bit similar once the mask is off. Yeah.
They're obsessed with young females.
Mm-hmm. Unhealthily so.
Yeah.
And I've heard people say in the past that Caves is a rewrite of Power of Krull. I personally don't buy into that, except
it has a refinery. It has a twin planet system where they're refining things and taking them back to the other planet. And it's also got gunrunners, so there are some strong connections there.
And the double dealing where Morgus or Thawne are funding both sides. But
that's right.
In Krull, they're mining the digestive emissions of the enormous octopus, whereas in Androzani, they are mining the elixir of life, which I think is a much better market-based, consumer-based solution.
But you've got to remember that Robert Holmes had a wicked sense of humor and was always trying to inject smut into the scripts as much as he possibly can. So you've basically substituted squid farts for milking bats tits.
Which leads to my very last question about Androzani proper. Why didn't the Doctor just drink his half of the bat's milk before he climbed upstairs?
Well, Terence Dix in the novelization actually says that he milked the bat dry.
Mm.
That there's no more to be had from the bat. I don't know if that's from the script, but certainly that's the explanation in the but you're right, he could have still drunk his half, right?
The Magma Beast worked for me for reasons we've mentioned, but that's the only part of the story that doesn't quite work for me.
There we go. Page 128. There was just enough of the precious fluid to fill the little flask. Squeezing out the last few drops, the Doctor stoppered the phial and put it carefully in his pocket.
Ah.
There you go.
Terrence is always coming up with these on the fly solutions.
Yeah. I don't say that while we're on the subject of the novelization, which I guess is the whole point of the us talking about this. the things I noticed as I was reading this where Terrence really sort of isn't paying attention to what he's doing. On page 36, he's got the president snorted. He's got two lines apart, exactly the same line.
Oh, you're right. You're right.
And that just seems really right, sort of inattentive writing there.
He's done that before. He referred to somebody in a previous book as a grizzled gray-haired veteran. Mm. Grizzled, of course, meaning gray-haired.
Yeah.
So he was writing these very, very quickly.
Yeah. There's also a point, too, where he describes the belt plates that they wear to protect themselves against the androids. When the Doctor first studies one, he describes to the reader what it looks like, and then later on when Chelak's looking at it, he puts the same description in again, and they're going, you're doing this for the benefit of the reader, you've already described it once, and then you're just putting, it's almost like he's forgotten that he's already described it. But, you know, you could argue that's just poor editing, that the editor should have been responsible for picking up on those things.
And Terrence was no longer doing a book a month at this point, but he probably wrote this very, very quickly because he certainly was busy with other aspects of his professional career.
I think by this point, and like I mentioned, I did research Five Doctors reasonably recently, that Terrence was working for the BBC as a classics serial producer by this point. So he had a lot on his plate in terms of his regular day job. So the Target books were probably being written in the weekends, maybe on his days off, you know. Certainly wasn't his sole source of income. He had a regular producing job at the BBC at this time, so he didn't quite have so much time. So while we talk about how the original script writers certainly wanted to start writing the Target books from the Davison era onwards, I think also Terrence's time was quite limited, so he probably welcomed the fact that he wasn't doing quite so much work on them.
I'm going to be talking more about the Caves book after the break when I do my audio essay. I think that Terrence does complement Robert Holmes's underlying story very well. You've helped me fill in a lot of the gaps as to what of the TV production belonged to Holmes and what belonged to the in-studio production team. We have not quite, to coin a phrase, milked the subject dry. I could talk to you all day about the production notes and about Androzani, but as I don't want these recordings to be 5-hour podcasts, I do want to jump over to the games portion of the evening. So we have played a few different recurring games on this podcast. Paul, you and I have played 20 Questions. I believe the last time that you were on, it's been almost a year. And we have also played with other guests, Guess That Cliffhanger. I have a new game that I want to try out. I'm going to limit this to the classic series for now. I want to do a Name the Quote. So my idea is I have picked out three quotes for you. They're not the famous quotes. They're not the obvious quotes. Since this is the inaugural version of Name the Quote, two of these I've picked because they're personal favorites of mine, and one of them I took the story out of the randomizer and then took what I thought was a nifty quote from the story that I got out of the randomizer.
So you're expecting me to know all of the dialogue from all of the classic series, is that what you're saying?
And if anybody could do it, it would probably be you.
Oh, gosh. can I just say, going back to what we were talking about with the production notes, and this is pertinent to this, I know the stories that I've worked on incredibly well, but I only have a fan level of knowledge of every other story. So there's a great disparity between those stories I've researched and those that I haven't.
But I will give you, of course, liberal hints for each one until you give up. Are you ready to play?
Yeah, why not? Let's go for it.
All right. And I'll go with what is probably the best-known story first, just to give you a quote-unquote easy one. And I'm going to just read the words on the page. I'm not going to try and do the acting, because my acting skills are, to quote Peter Davison in Caves of Androzani, comparatively feeble. Not all human beings are automatically allies. There are people who will kill for a few scraps of food. That's quote number one, name the story, and for a bonus second point, name the speaker.
Oh, gosh. Oh, can you narrow it down for me at all?
Not all human beings are automatically allies. This narrows it down to a story that takes place on Earth, but an Earth that is under very distraught, distressed conditions where civilization has possibly collapsed, and even the people who are fighting the good fight do not necessarily have allies in everybody they meet. It also sets up a scene a few minutes later where one of the companions is sold into slavery for food.
Is it from Dalek Invasion of Earth?
It is from Dalek Invasion of Earth.
Not a story I've seen in a very long time.
Definitely a story worth seeing.
I love the story. I just haven't got around to rewatching it in recent years.
So I'll just tell you, the speaker is David Campbell. It's the scene in the sewers where I think David has to shoot somebody off screen.
Gotcha.
That's my memory of it.
Yeah.
It's not the most famous quote in the story. That would be the doctor's farewell speech to Susan, but it's a standout line.
But that would have just given it away.
True.
Yeah.
Second one. No opinion can be worse sometimes than a very dogmatic one.
Oh, gosh.
The reason why I've picked this quote, it is a story that is generally derided as being slow-moving and poorly made. And it's from very early on in its particular production team's run. And the person who wrote it never wrote for Doctor Who again. But that particular line is a great bit of philosophy in the middle of a story that otherwise is very few people's favorites. I actually quoted it at work a few days ago in a work email.
Oh, gosh. Which Doctor's era? Can you give me that much?
I'll tell you, it is the very first era. It is the first Doctor and
the Sensorites.
It is the Sensorites. Yes! Excellent.
Yes.
Do you remember in story terms who would have said it?
Not a clue.
It would have been the first Elder.
Right.
All right. It's again, I have seen criticism of the Sensorites for it being slowly paced. and criticism of the fact that the Sensorites can't tell each other apart visually, which for me, because they're a telepathic species, I think facial recognition would be a little less important.
Sure.
And also, it takes 7 minutes for Jaqueline Hill to walk down a narrow corridor in episode 2 because they were running low on a... They had to really pad out the episode to fit the running time of the studio block. I really love the Sensorites, and I think RTD does also, because when he invented the Ood, they're basically the Sensorites 2.0.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think he's got a lot of affection for the Hartnell era, which I think we're seeing with Neil Patrick Harris in the new series.
I do find it odd that the trailer did not mention the name of the character, but then they had a separate BBC Twitter press release saying Neil Patrick Harris was the toy maker.
Yeah, that was weird. I saw the press release first, so I went into watching the trailer going, oh, he's going to mention the toy maker, and I go, where was that bit?
What's even worse is that I saw, I don't have the Doctor Who BBC feed tweets pushed to my phone, but I do have Paul Simpson's tweets pushed to my phone because he has Sci-Fi Bulletin. Mm-hmm. So I learned about the trailer from his tweet pushing to my phone in the middle of the afternoon as I was editing episode 91, Frontios, which is being released live as soon as you and I hang up. I did a quick, instant reaction to the new trailer as part of my Frontios episode, but I didn't know that this is the Toymaker because the trailer doesn't say so, and I never saw that other tweet until much later in the day. So I asked, episode, who is he playing? And then I also misheard one of the lines that David Tennant goes shouty shouty in that particular trailer, so
yeah.
I made two errors in my instant reaction. So let's get to the third and final quote, and I'm omitting the name of a character in the middle of the quote because that would be a dead giveaway. Tell me on the way, you must cultivate a sense of urgency. I may have to dial back the difficulty level of this game.
you might need to give a clue. Can you narrow it?
Yes, the missing name. Tell me on the way, Brigadier. Tell me on the way. You must cultivate a sense of urgency.
Is it Mordred Undead?
Oh, good guess. No, I'll give you another hint. It is a doctor who is meeting the Brigadier for the first time in his incarnation, but it is not the Peter Davison doctor.
Oh, okay. Oh, gosh. It's not Battlefield, is it?
No, also a good guess. I'll just tell you that it's the fourth Doctor.
Right, so is it Robot then?
It is. It is Robot.
Ah. See, the problem with this, and the fault is entirely my own making, is that all three of the quotes are from stories that I've not watched in a very long time.
I did not tailor the quotes to you. Maybe I should have. Maybe the next time I will tailor the quotes.
That's all right.
To the particular, like when I had my daughter as a guest on this show and I wanted to play a game with her, I wanted to play Guess That Cliffhanger because she wouldn't have been able to do 20 questions, but she'd only seen one story. So I just, all three cliffhangers were the three cliffhangers from the story that she'd watched. I couldn't quite do that for you,
that for Kazu and Dazani, and I could have told you which the cliffhangers were. This is the terrible thing. Well, is it a terrible thing? I don't know. The terrible thing about working on Doctor Who professionally is that you tend to just gravitate to the stuff you're working on, and you never really get the chance to watch very much more of the series than you need to for work. So I've watched over and over and over again the stories that I have researched and written info text for, to the point where I could tell you, you know, infinitesimal details about them, but the stories that I haven't worked on have slipped into distant far memory for the most part, because I literally don't find enough time in my day to watch Doctor Who for pleasure anymore. So you know, it's a sad thing to say, but I haven't watched, you know, Doctor Who that I haven't needed to for work for quite a while.
I think I will have to have you back next time for a story that you have not written the notes for, that you're going to be less familiar with, just to get your instant reaction.
Yeah. Would you like me to watch it beforehand or not?
Yes.
But I mean, you know, it's interesting to get me for a story. I mean, I'm very interested to hear what when I listen to it, what you say about Frontios, because that's a story I did work on. So I'm keen to hear your reaction to that, because it's a story I know incredibly well. So any of those stories that I've worked on are ones that would be, you know, a great interest to me. I mean, you could have me on for something like, you know, Mark of the Rani, and I could tell you enormous amount of facts of stuff that you wouldn't know from watching the television story. You know, Vengeance on Varos, you know, any of those ones that I've worked on. So, but yeah, you know, I'm happy to come back whenever you like.
For Frontios, my guest was Cy Hart, making his 7th appearance on the show. We are both very extreme fans of Frontios. Cy even more so than me. So the episode is a very affectionate look and a bit of a love fest for the story and for the book. But of course, we don't go into that behind the scenes detail because we were lacking your particular knowledge.
No, I'm looking forward to listening to that one.
Paul, thank you so much for taking your time to talk to me. And I hope to see a lot more of your work coming up on future Blu-ray sets that I am desperate to have, but which have not been announced yet.
Oh, yes, there are more to come. I can tell you at least that much.
All righty, have a great night, my friend.
Cheers, thank you.
Doctor Who, The Caves of Androzani, by Terrence Dix. Televised as The Caves of Androzani, teleplay by Robert Holmes, televised in March 1984, paperback release date, February 14th, 1985. Heck of a story to come out on Valentine's Day. Target book number, 92, cover artist, Andrew Skilleter. From the moment they land on the planet Androzani Minor, everything goes wrong for the Doctor and his new young companion, Perry. They become involved in the struggle between brutal gunrunners, ruthless Federation troops, and the hideously mutilated Shara's Jek, who lurks in the depths of the caves with his android army. Key to the struggle is Spectrox, the most valuable substance in the universe. Suitably processed, Spectrox is an elixir of life, but in its raw state, it is a deadly poison, a fact which will cost the Doctor another of his Time Lord lives. Perry blinked, and in that blinking of an eye, there was a different Doctor in the TARDIS. Page 135. To put it mildly, and to not be over the top or portentous, The Caves of Androzani is the greatest Doctor Who story of all time, due in large part to having the greatest script of all time. Note, my top 60 list is coming out in November on this podcast and may feature a different number one. But that doesn't change the fact that Caves of Androzani is still the greatest Doctor Who story of all time. It's got everything. A little Count of Monte Cristo, a little Phantom of the Opera, check that, a lot of Phantom of the Opera, a little film noir, liberal amounts of gunfighting and political backstabbing, or in one case, political front shoving, and a little Hunchback of Notre Dame, check that, a lot of Hunchback. How does Terrence Dix do with the novelization? How does Terrence, with his reputation for slim books topping out on 105 pages max, do with the most perfect Robert Holmes script ever? Big shoes to fill, right? I think he fills them. Terrence gives everything away in the prologue, the first 2 pages of chapter 1, and lets us know everything that we're in for. He sets the scene perfectly, and we are off from there. Now, Paul mentioned to me earlier that this could be seen as spoon-feeding, but I think it does fit the tone of a particular type of children's literature where spoon-feeding is almost expected. The characters in Androzani are vivid. Everybody gets great lines. Working from Holmes's material, Terrence keys up his narrative descriptions of the characters to match. Stotz is, quote, good-looking in a villainous kind of way. Krelper, Stotz is number 2. Is, quote, seedy and depressed-looking. Later on, while worried, quote, as usual, he was whining about it. General Chelak, as a soldier, is, quote, conscientious rather than inspired, and he wears a depressed,
defeated look. Love those. Chillax HQ has the, quote, shabby, worn air of a place designed for temporary use that has somehow become permanent. Chillax, who makes a series of disastrous command decisions throughout the story, takes refuge in authority when defeated in logic. Morgus, one of the all-time great villains, and I think you'll agree with me that he has one of the all-time great villains' names, bears, quote, thin, pinched features, frozen in an expression of distaste. Krya Timmon, we learn early, always agreed with everything her employer said. Outwardly, at least, her private thoughts she kept very much to herself, not to give the plot away. And, like many politicians, the president was handsome, in a rather actorish way. Ha! Bear in mind this book was written during the Ronald Reagan presidency, then came out just a few weeks after Ronald Reagan's second term inauguration. Shara's Jack, when he shows up, is called a phantom, and yes, I think Terrence chose that word with precision. Jack's print reaction to Morgus' gun in the final chapter is also a delight. Terrence also weaves in explanations for Robert Holmes' signature world-building references, like telling us exactly what Chakhaws are and how they are picked. The android that doesn't shoot the Doctor in Part 2 is given a dizzyingly funny POV sequence, and Terrence does not stint on adding even more wicked elements to Holmes' portrayal of the double-dealing and the backstabbing. He has Morgus observe that it took the president, quote, a surprisingly long time to plunge down the elevator shaft to his death. And Terrence adds a suitably cynical and witty explanation for why Morgus orders the lift engineer to be shot. Terrence clearly loves this story. His additions make it impossibly even better. Robert Holmes was magical at his best. Terrence Dix was magical at his best. Together, with one scripting and the other novelizing, they are transcendent. Now, I'm not just showering empty praise upon this story or upon this book. Think about this. In the midst of the treachery and death, Robert Holmes scripted a Doctor, the Fifth Doctor, as noble and heroic as we'd never seen him before. The man who stood above it all and literally died for his companion, excepting the plot hole of why the Doctor doesn't just drink his half of the bat's milk as soon as he takes it. And Terrence adds bounce to the Fifth Doctor in print beyond what we saw on TV. Walking across Androzani Minor's barren, rocky surface in the opening scenes, the Doctor was, quote, as alert and interested as if they'd been visiting one of the great beauty spots of the universe. That's the essence of the Doctor right there, making the mundane extraordinary. Terrence gets it. Androzani on TV was certainly a triumph for Peter Davison, one of his apexes in the role, and the book does him justice, too. The Doctor didn't really expect this approach to work, and it didn't, is one such Terrence quote. The Doctor is able to memorize a map of the Androzani Minor cave system at one glance, which is an attribute that Terrence also gave the Doctor in the Hand of Fear novelization. You might be wondering if the seminal Part 3 cliffhanger, one of the finest Doctor Hero moments in 56 plus years of Doctor Who, works in novelization form. In a word, yeah. In two words, hell yeah.
Doctor! Unlock this door! What are you doing in there?
Are you going to open this door or not?
Ah, Stutzy, have you had a good rest?
Damn you, Doctor, open this door!
Sorry, it seems to be locked.
Come on, go get the cutting gear.
Now listen, Doctor, be reasonable. This won't do you any good.
Stutzy, we'll be touching down in a couple of minutes, or more likely crashing down, you see. I'm a bit out of practice with manual landing, so if I were you, I'd find something firm to hang on to.
I'll murder you when I get in there, Doctor.
Why?
Because I'll kill you if you don't!
Not a very persuasive argument, actually.
here's how Terence handles the material on page 102. With astonishing speed, the lance sliced a jagged square panel out of the door. Punched from the outside, the panel dropped into the control room with a clang. Through the resultant gap, the doctor saw an enraged Stotts glaring at him. Stotts reached his hand through the hole to open the door, and gave a yell of agony as his wrist touched the still red-hot rim of the gap. Abandoning the idea, he leveled his machine pistol at the doctor. "All right, Snoop. Hands in the air. Come over here and open that door." "Why?" "Because I'll kill you if you don't." The doctor laughed. "Not a very persuasive argument, actually, Stotts, because I'm going to die anyway. Unless, of course..." "I'll give you to a count of three," screamed Stotts. "One." Quite unperturbed, the doctor went on. "Unless, of course, I can find the antidote." "Two. I owe it to my friend Perry to try, because I got her into this. So you see, I'm not going to let you stop me now." The doctor closed his eyes. On the screen, the surface of Androzani Minor rushed closer. Dot, dot, dot. A little bit of narrative exposition to flesh it out, but otherwise, Terence lets the words, the dialogue that is, speak for themselves. Perry, too, gets a thought that has to rank as one of the darkest and most powerful sentences that Terence Dix ever wrote. After she's been kidnapped by Jack a second time, Perry thinks, and again, this is Terence, not Robert Holmes, if this was all that lay ahead of her, it was almost a relief to recall that she was dying. Tell me again that Terence was just churning it out. One lovely minor aspect to Holmes' TV work is that he wrote real characters with inner lives. His characters often stop to explain the plot to one another, and get it utterly wrong. Characters lie, characters exaggerate, like when Stotts recounts for Morgus his negotiations with Shara's Jack to give himself a more heroic role. Terence picks up on this, and giddily comments on the action. Morgan here reaches, quote, an impeccably logical and totally incorrect conclusion. Terence also delights in pointing out how Morgus is losing control of the plot, and how he starts to panic, as the Doctor's wild-card involvement in the plot changes how every character acts, and leads them, especially Morgus, Chellak, and Stotts, into increasingly bad decisions with dire, fatal consequences. Terence also embellishes nicely on the already grim and funereal Part 4, adding Morgus's desire to kill Stotts, not really suggested on screen, and adding the Doctor's thought that he might have to kill Shara's Jack in order to save Perry. Again, this is Terence giving us stuff that is not in Robert Holmes' script or in Graham Harper's production. Brr.
Well, Stotts, no doubt you're wondering why I'm here.
Hey, you're the boss.
Yes, well, there's a possibility, I wouldn't put it any stronger than that, that my part in all this has been discovered.
You mean the gun running and collecting...
Exactly. But my conscience is clear. I had to keep a supply of Spectrox flowing. And if I hadn't provided Jack with the arms, he'd have found some other source. But the Presidium will find my actions treasonable.
Yeah, well, I guess they'd execute us all if they could catch us.
Yes, well, I have a contingency plan. There's a possibility that my part in all this was suspected only by the President. That's why he sent the doctor here. But the President is dead. And if he shared his suspicions with anyone else, I shall know within a few hours. In which case, I shall not be able to return to Androzani Major. I have a considerable private fortune invested in other planets in the Sirius system. But before I go, I want to take with me Jack's private hoard of Spectrox. That is the key to unlimited power.
Jack isn't going to let that go easily.
Yes, but you know where it is.
Well, sort of. It must be close to Cave 26 on yellow level.
Stotts, before I left, Major was informed the army intended to attack Jack's headquarters in strength tonight. Now, while he's fighting the army, we could locate the Spectrox store. What do you think?
Maybe. Yellow level isn't too deep. But what about these mud bursts?
If we go into the cave rigs after the first one, we could be back here before the major explosion. As long as we don't waste time trying to locate the Spectrox store.
Yes, well, that's the point. We don't know exactly where Jack has stored it.
I'm relying on you, Stotts. What about the others?
They'll want their cut.
Yes. Well, if they can carry 50 kilos each, that's 100 to share between us.
You mean us?
Something remarkable about that scene, by the way, which is nearly 2 minutes of secondary characters talking to one another. You don't get this kind of scene, by and large, in the new series. two non-regulars in this one serial only, taking up 2 minutes of screen time, shot at very close quarters by Graham Harper, with Maurice Rose, and I hope I'm saying that correctly, occasionally looking over his shoulder at the camera. Remarkable, powerful stuff. And these two actors, including the great John Normington as Morgus, absolutely give it their all, acting their socks off in this one nearly 2 minute scene. Now, Paul had mentioned earlier that Terrence very likely was working from a videotape copy of the story as he was writing the novelization. It does appear that some of Graham Harper's more visually inventive TV directorial flourishes are missing. This would include any last-minute changes from rehearsal or the day of recording that would not be preserved in the camera scripts. John Normington turning to the camera and delivering Shakespearean soliloquies, not in the book. Largely, those passages are delivered in straight dialogue, and his print death is not quite as interesting as the TV portrayal in Part 4. We also lose some of the more striking match cuts or dissolves between scenes, all stuff that I would chalk up to Graham Harper in studio. The Doctor does not apparently hold back his regeneration in Stotz' spaceship, with the video regeneration effect lines appearing on the monitor screen as the Doctor is flying to Androzani Minor. Now the Doctor does not apologize to an absent Perry while about to be shot in the sand dunes. Now it's hard to find much fault with Terrence's writing in a technical sense. Paul had mentioned earlier some repetitive wordplay, and I would add that Terrence uses the word hare, H-A-R-E, as in to run like a rabbit, twice in three paragraphs. In Chapter 10, I did think the description of the mudburst as sounding like a million whistling tea kettles was a bit of an odd selection of prose, but that is a direct lift from Holmes' script directions. The action sequences, though, are generally, well, technically flawless, a delight to read aloud. Quote, "Suddenly a stream of boiling mud flooded through the caves, pouring over the ground and flying through the air at the same time, forced through the caves under pressure by some vast eruption in the seething planetary core." Not a wasted word. At the same time, Terrence excels at covering up any flaws inherent in a low-budget TV production. In a story filled with non-speaking extras, Terrence amusingly refers to Stotz's longest-surviving gunrunner extra as a taciturn type, well, to put it mildly. That extra couldn't speak on camera, or he would have been had to get paid scale. Then you couldn't ask for a better print regeneration than the one the Doctor writes here. Quote, "It was nice of all his old friends to come and see him. But surely Adric shouldn't be here. Adric was dead. But then, perhaps he was dead himself," thought the Doctor. "That would account for it." Exquisite. Absolutely exquisite.
"What was it you always told me, Doctor? Braveheart? You
must
survive, Doctor.
You must survive. Too many of your enemies would delight in your death, Doctor.
Braveheart? You're needed. You mustn't die, Doctor.
Too many of your enemies would delight in your death, Doctor.
You know
You're
that,
needed.
Doctor.
You mustn't die, Doctor.
You know that, Doctor.
Adric?
You know that.
You mustn't die, Doctor.
No, my dear Doctor, you must die. Die, Doctor. Die, Doctor.
You're expecting someone else?
I...
That's three eyes in one breath. Makes you sound a rather egotistical young lady.
What's happened?
Change, my dear. And it seems not a moment too soon.
Next time on Doctor Who Literature. As you may have gathered from the end of that audio clip from part 4 of The Caves of Androzani, the torch has been passed to a new generation of Doctor, the Colin Baker Doctor, the Sixth Doctor, or, as he goes on Twitter, Sawbones Hex. However, in the target line, we are not quite yet ready for any Colin Baker story to be novelized. In real time, it will be about 2 more months on this program before we reach the first of the published Colin Baker novelizations. Instead, we are going back to the beginning, back to Season 1, back to Doctor Who's second historical. Joining us in a conversation that I have not recorded yet is Ross Aitken from Gallifrey's Most Wanted. Very excited to speak to him again. Once again, joining me for a Season 1 William Hartnell historical. We are going to talk about a 7-part epic, which, if you ask 100 fans of the classic series which missing Doctor Who serial would they most want back in full, I'm sure at least 97 of them would say Doctor Who. Marco Polo. Next time on Doctor Who Literature. And thank you for joining me on another episode of the Doctor Who Literature Podcast. The podcast is produced by David Barsky, Jim Sangster, and yours truly. This week's episode was written and edited by me. Our logo was designed by Jim Sangster. Special thanks to my special guest, Paul Schoons. This podcast can be found on most of your podcast apps of choice. You can find all past episodes at podcasters.spotify.com/pod/show/Doctor Who Lit. It really helps if you rate 5 stars and subscribe. You can find me on Twitter and Mastodon and Blue Sky as Doctor Who Novels, that's Dr. Who Novels, and on email at Doctor Who Literature, that's drwholiterature@gmail.com. Please drop me a line with your comments, questions, and suggestions. Thank you for listening, and whatever you do, keep turning the pages.
Doctor Who Podcast Network.